arresting a minister who was allegedly stole money from his group, and they filed felony charges. I had so many cases. I had this railroad. I had a railroad case where the federal government accused the waiters on the Union of the Union Pacific of stealing because they kept their tips and so forth, and they arrested about 200 waiters, and I represented all of them. And
were these like the Pullman porters?
Union Pacific. See, this was the waiters rather than the porters, and the waiters were in all the different lines, and the government just made a concerted effort. I guess it's because of the fact the government wasn't being paid tax on the money, but you can imagine going to federal court for about 200 clients. So we handled it and disposed of the case. And
what happened?
They ended up saying, "Look, if we go to trial with 200 people, this case will take maybe a year and a half or 2 years. We will offer you a small fine to dispose of it." So we disposed of it, and that was it. And but it made headlines all across the country. And that, but we had a diversification of cases. And the thing that I'm very much aware of, though, is that where I put a lot of importance on cases, those cases right now don't rank money-wise at all with the cases that are developed today. For instance, these attorneys can go into these cases and get $1 million or so forth. Well, a million-dollar case in those days would just be, you might say, something that just, it was a miracle this didn't happen, but it's entirely different today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But considering what times were then, we were all satisfied. Yeah.
Yeah. There were some questions I wanted to go back to from the earlier days and pick up.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't ask you before was when you were growing up, did your family go places for leisure or...
Yes.
Local areas around town, where would you go?
Well, my father was a hard-working letter carrier, and he sold newspapers and distributed them. And at one time, he was president of an ice cream company that failed. And he was a church man, and my mother was a civic woman who believed in causes like YWCA, and she was also active in Parent Teachers Association. Their pleasures were very plain, and they were just good people, and no shows. My mother would, for instance, in those days they had orators who would appear from around the country. They had about four or five black public speakers who were orators, and we would go and hear them because they would make very fine, stirring addresses.
Where would that be? Where would they be?
They would be in the auditoriums downtown. They would have. There was a big hall downtown on Broadway, Oddfellows Hall, and we would go, and I remember sitting up in the balcony. I remember one speaker was named Chandler Owens. We also used to go and hear William Pickens. William Pickens was the field secretary of the NAACP. He was a Yale graduate, man, fine speaker and could tell homely jokes, and you just enjoy it. There was a man here from Harvard named Hugh Macbeth, who's got a son who's commissioner of Superior Court. Macbeth was a Harvard man, and he used to make addresses, and we'd go and hear him, and we'd be all spellbound. These were good, excellent speakers.
Do you remember what kind of subjects they were talking about, or just a lot of things?
Yes. One subject that was always, first presidential elections always attracted a lot of attention. Labor problems, labor unions, where unions would discriminate and would not permit blacks become members of the union. Firing, despite seniority, being fired first. And the secondary, I remember hearing Ralph Bunche. Now, you ever hear of Ralph Bunche?
Yeah.
Well, Ralph Bunche was a personal friend of mine. Ralph would, Mr. Eason, the man over here, Ralph was a protege of him. Mr. Eason was a professor of Greek and so forth.
Well, can you tell me again for the tape, too, Mr. Eason was Mr. Charles Lewis Eason?
Yes.
And what you said, he was the first...
He was the first black male teacher in Los Angeles. And everybody knew him by the name of Professor. He was a graduate of Oberlin College. And he taught in some black colleges languages. Well, Mr. Eason, because of his great interest in education, took a personal interest in Ralph Bunche. And Mr. Eason worked, when he would leave school in the afternoon, he'd come down and work with my father in the real estate business. He wouldn't do much soliciting or anything like that, but he'd sit behind the desk with about three or four other old gentlemen, and all these old gentlemen who are probably younger than I am now. These old gentlemen would have some great confabs back there. So Mr. Eason would get Ralph Bunche to come down there. Now, Ralph Bunche was a star basketball player at UCLA. They didn't call it UCLA. They called it. Yes, it was. Anyway, so Ralph would come with his blue sweater and blazing with gold. He'd come to there, and he and Mr. Eason would have tremendous conversations. And so Ralph, my mother, would always prepare every day. We had a house behind the office. She'd go back there and prepare lunches for all these men. And she just got no paying or anything like that. And a lot of the college guys would come by there, too.
This was also on Central Avenue.
Yes. Yeah, and so Ralph would come by, and Judge Jefferson, there are two judges of Jefferson. Judge Edwin Jefferson was of the District Court of Appeals, and Bernard Jefferson also made the District Court of Appeals. Their father was a little old gentleman who worked for my father and mother in caretaking for property. But so this little gentleman must have taken a lot of solace out of the fact that here he had two sons on the District Court of Appeal. Yeah. And he had another daughter who was Ruby Jefferson, who was secretary of YWCA here. So, but now as far as Ralph Bunche is concerned, we were talking about speeches. Ralph, I remember, gave a very scholarly discourse at the, what's the place out in Hollywood? The great open air place.
Oh, the Hollywood Bowl?
Hollywood Bowl. And the subject was secondary citizenship.
What year was this?
This would be rather late. Let's see, what was this? something had happened. I should imagine this would be about 60. And he discussed the fact that Declaration of Independence, no, the Constitution of the United States didn't make any specific references anywhere in wherein the government could reduce persons' citizenship to first stage or second stage, and that citizenship was citizenship, and he would bring up the various complaints that could be leveled at the government for not enforcing certain laws. And he made a very interesting address. He later came down and visited me and spent some time with me at the office. And I noticed his hands were trembling a great deal. And he apparently had delirium tremens at that time. And later, B. Devon, the woman I pointed out to you and spelled her name, B. Devon threw a party for some of us old timers here, and he was there. And it wasn't long after he died. I think B. Devon must have realized that he was very ill.
He died pretty young. Hmm? Was he pretty young then when he died?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. That was Ralph Bunch. We all used to play basketball together at the old YMCA on East 9th Street. That's where it was then. And there was some very talented guys that used to play basketball there. But Ralph stood out, and some of them became eminent doctors, and on the whole, this turned out. And another thing, I didn't realize it then, I didn't appreciate it then, so many of them were excellent athletes, good scholars and excellent athletes. There was a certain street in Hollywood where there were blacks living named on Commonwealth. And there was a Dr. Stovall that came back here after taking his medicine. And Stovall had a nephew named Will Allen. Now, Will Allen Stovall rivaled Bunch in everything except that he excelled in athletics. Brilliant speaker, and won all the sprinting contests and the high jump contests at UCLA. And he was a decathlon man. And this boy, they had a big steamship running between here and San Francisco that the fellows who were going to the various colleges could work. And it was a passenger ship called the H.F. Alexander. So the guys would look forward from one season to another to get on the H.F. Alexander during the summertime. And so Will Allen got to working on this H.F. Alexander and two or three other guys. And they succumbed to an opportunity to make some big money. And it ended up, it just wrecked their careers. They started drinking. Will Allen Stovall just went from something to nothing. And these were some of the temptations during those times. Mm-hmm. And but I at least remember that the H.F. Alexander was a benefactor to a lot of the guys going to school.
Back when we were talking about what you used to do for leisure when you were growing up, and you had mentioned the oratories, did you ever go places for picnics or to the beach?
Yes, I used to go each year to Brookside Park. And Brookside Park would have the annual Sunday school picnic, and all the kids, black kids from all the Sunday schools in Los Angeles, would go out there. They'd have tennis matches and so forth. And Newell Easton, the lad I mentioned, was a great tennis player. There was a fellow named Rayfield Lundy used to play. And we would spend the whole day out there. But the annual Brookside Park picnic was something. They had a man-made place in Watts called Leakes Lake. Leak, L-E-A-K-E-S. A man-made pool. And we'd go out there. And this is right in Watts. You don't hear of it today. We would also go a lot of times at a park that is not, you don't hear too much of it anymore, but people would go every Sunday. You see hordes of people at Lincoln Park. A lot of people would go to Echo Park. These parks, but in those days, it would be a dress-up crowd, and where they're having fun, where they had concessions, and they had sky rides and all those things. The Exhibition Park wasn't so well known. They didn't talk too much about it, but it was Lincoln and those parks that I mentioned. Yeah.
How about the beaches?
Beaches, we had, there was a black beach called Bruce's Beach. And the Bruces had this building there, and they had, and the blacks would flock around Bruce's Beach, and they would rent bathing suits and so forth, and a big crowd would go there all
the
holidays.
Near Manhattan Beach?
Is that Bruce's Beach? Is right next to Redondo Beach. And I remember this, you would take Slauson to go there. So it would be right near Slauson Avenue.
So all the beaches were segregated up until...
The beaches were... I'm hazy on the subject. I know I didn't go in any other beach but Bruce's Beach. And apparently we weren't welcome at the other beaches.
I heard there was a black beach at Santa Monica. There was a certain section there you could go to.
Yes, that's true. I remember something about that, but Bruce's Beach was the one that attracted most of the people. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what else did they have out there? There was a place to rent bathing suits and...
Yeah, and let's see.
Did a lot of people go there?
Oh, you could buy soda water and so forth, and you could lay out on the beach. And the kids could have a good time, but that was about it. I remember the driving in my automobile. I had a little automobile that I would go to the beach in and see all the people on the road on Slauson. Didn't have freeways then. I would hit Slauson and go straight on out there, and Slauson was a deserted district then. You were really out in the country then, going to the beach. Yeah.
Wow.
What else?
So when did your family move away from Rose Hill? The area out near Pasadena?
Rose Hill.
Uh-huh. And then where did you live after that?
Well,
what areas
of
town have you lived in?
I moved from Rose Hill. I would say about 1928, after I came back from Boston. When I went to Boston to get in Harvard and couldn't, I stayed there and worked about a year and a half in the laundry. And then I came back on the Luckenbach line, Andre Luckenbach line, steamship, to the Panama Canal, came home. And right after that, I moved. I didn't move with other people, but I moved to the house where my father had taken back from that George Godfrey incident, when I told you that they gave this fighter trouble about moving in out there on 58th Drive. Well, my father took back the property, and there's a rear house there. And my father and I had a little run-in about one of my women friends, and so I moved there and paid him rent and stayed there. Stayed there till I went away to school. And my father and I had a complete reconciliation. We were all right because he went down before I went away. He got me a, it was a second hand, but it was a fine looking sport car, and that's what I drove back to Ohio. Yeah.
Well, when you moved into the house that Godfrey used to live in,
yeah.
Or was going to live in, did you have any problems?
Things had cooled down, and didn't have any problems. We did have problems previously, or when we first took it over. And on one particular night, everybody from my office went out there, prepared for trouble. That was the last incident I knew about. We had had several incidents out there in Rose Hill where I was living, where things would erupt, not directly aimed at us, but at a general situation where the iceberg could probably pull over on us, so we would be prepared for trouble. Like, for instance, the time they put the sign on over the boulevard, "Japs don't let the sun set on you here." Well, we didn't know what was going to happen because everybody was so concerned and up. And then when Mr. Eason moved out there, there was a little rumble. It wasn't a general neighborhood protest. It would be one or two people that had caused like other situations, who probably, like one family out there, was always raising hell and the people were getting drunk in the house. This is a white family, and they weren't too much approved by the rest of the whites. And these people, you could expect trouble on any issue at any time coming from their house. And this is the kind of thing we ran into.
So then where did your family move then after?
My family stayed right there.
Uh-huh.
They never did move.
Oh, right.
And they were killed there. Yeah.
But then you were saying, like, when your father had the real estate place?
Yes.
On Central Avenue?
Yes.
They also had a place there?
All through that time, they were living in Rose Hill.
Oh, okay, I see.
See,
okay.
That was a residence.
All right. So then you moved on to 58th Place, and then
right.
You went to Ohio.
Right.
And then when you came back, where did you live?
When I came back, I stayed at my home a couple of nights, and then got a room with some youngsters in town where I wouldn't have to go so far. And I worked at my father's and had my office at my father's place with another fellow that I brought out here from Ohio. And I'd work at my father's place, selling real estate, giving dances and so forth.
Right.
But there was no estrangement or anything like that. We were... it was just an accommodation for me. I didn't have to drive way out there to go home at night.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When you drove your car from here to Ohio?
Yeah.
That was, what, the early 30s?
It was in June or July 1932.
Yeah, what was that like, driving your car that far?
I was accompanied by two boys who were going back to Wilberforce University. It's called Central State now. And so they had been on the route before, and we...
What road was it? What roads did you take?
This was 66, and went through Texas, and I forgot that place they call the high place in Texas. What do you call that? Anyway.
The Panhandle?
Went to Texas, no. Oklahoma, went on through. I remember we stopped off in St. Louis, and then came on to Xenia, Ohio first, and then I came on to Columbus.
So where would you, what time of day would you drive, or would you drive all day and then stop and stay somewhere at the night, and what kind of places did you stay?
and drive and sleep at night, most of the night, in the car. Didn't have no accommodations anyway on the way.
Why not?
So all slept in the car. And wouldn't dare take a chance trying to find accommodations. See? By the way, one of the first things you learn on the road was when you hit the town, was asked where the colored section of the town was. Then you'd go there and you'd find a restaurant. And then you could sleep somewhere around in that district in your car. And that's the gist of it. It wasn't... the trip was uneventful in both instances, except when I came home from Ohio State, I had a brand new Pontiac, and I remember the license plate was, this was a blue car, and white sidewall tires, and it had this white blue license, GX7, and the fella with me was tall, reddish face, very fair black fella named Nickens. And when we'd hit any of those southern towns, those little towns, we'd go to the black section and park in front of one of those poo-haws and go walking in the poo-haw, and man, everybody would be looking at us and they'd point to that license plate and they swore we were government men. That's right. They swore up and down we were government. It shows all kinds of respect. And I remember we went to a pool hall in El Paso, Texas on June 22nd, 1936. And there was a big prize fight. Smelling knocked out Joe Louis. We was in this pool hall when that happened. And we were some sick guys because we thought we were going to get to stay there a little while. And Smelly knocked the man out, Joe Louis out, in about the first 10 seconds. So
what was the reaction around you?
It was just complete amazement. They just couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. So we got in the car and got in the car and started on out this way. But... what a day to remember, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you have children?
Yes.
How many?
I have three. I have twins and a boy. And the twins are Ann and Jim, James. And the boy is Walter III. And he's a lawyer.
How old are they now?
He was born in 1942 in March, so he's 51. I'll be 52, I guess, this coming March. Yeah.
And what do they do, your children?
Well, he's a lawyer, and he graduated. He got his A.B. He got his A.B. at Ohio State, got his master's at UCLA, and got his Ph.D. at UCLA, and. He is practicing law, and he taught some courses at UCLA in legal procedure.
Does he live in
yes.
the LA area?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And yeah. your other children?
Mm-hmm.
And your other children?
He has a child.
No, I mean your twins?
The twins. Ann is a secretary, and Jim is, you might say... kind of semi-invalid, and both of them, that is, Jim went pretty far in school and taught Spanish for some time. He's taught in South America, and he just matter of succumbed to the environment, and off the cuff, he's gay. So that's it.
Where were you during World War II, and what do you remember about it?
1942?
World War II.
Yeah. World War II, I remember the...
Can you hold on a second? I'm just going to pause this for a minute.
No. I'll explain it. He's gay. He told me he was gay. And I took him around and introduced him to lawyers who were gay and who were successful. And I was going to let him know, and I wanted to let him know, that that was no impediment. And that he could just get in and fight battles just like anybody else. And he at least had encouragement for me to do everything. And so, and I've always felt that way. And I've had clients who were gay, and I've been good friends with them. And that smug attitude about differences in people, yeah, I just don't indulge in it. So that's it.
That's important. I was going to ask you about your experience of World War II.
I was practicing law. I had this office going. I was representing all these various railroad men. I was the draft board man told me that, "Gordon, you are a real asset to the community, and we need you." And he says, "You might have to go, but we're going to do everything in the world to hold you here for a while." And I remember that they prepared the papers for me in the office and told me to sign them, and they constantly deferred me. And there's no question I was doing a lot of work, free work for guys, and I didn't expect this reward. I frankly put so much into it that my father, who was a little more observing than other people, I remember came to me and told me, "Look, I'm glad you're an industrious and all that." He said, "But you look horrible, and you're going to pieces, and you're putting too much work in there, and you can't stand these hours at 8, 9, and 10 o'clock at night." He said, "Now, damn it, I want you to stop it." And he was just on the verge of a stroke himself. But that was the attitude that people had. And so they deferred me. And
were there very many men left around during that time?
There weren't many deferments that time. And it was a tough draft board, too.
Most of the men were gone.
Yes, yeah. I was just, you can see how old I was in 30. This would be the draft board. What is that? What year would that be in? Yeah. Anyway, they were just a pretty bunch of stern guys, and one man in particular, I remember, he told me that along with the line, that he was the head of a certain political party there at that time. And he says, furthermore, he says, "We want you to run for a political office maybe down the way and help us to get some changes around here, and we need you." So I didn't quarrel with
him. Right. What work were the people who stayed, who didn't go, what work were people involved with in during that time, during World War II? What changes did you notice?
Except that the OPA and so forth, they had money coming in, and as far as ordinary labor is concerned, there weren't much changes. For instance, you didn't see black girls working in banks. You didn't see black secretaries downtown. You didn't see a lot of the jobs that are open today. Those were still the same way. Most of the women were doing maid work, and the men were janitorial work. The city employees were street sweepers. And there was no...
What about the shipyards and all of the new
went
work?
To shipworks, and they worked also the rubber plants, Goodyear and Firestone. That I remember lots of them were working down there, and the shipyards. That was it.
I've heard that during that time was a time when great numbers of African Americans came to Los Angeles because there was work here, so much work because of the war and the industry.
A lot of them came here.
Did you notice that during that time?
Oh yes, because we saw the town grow. See, and don't forget, as a young man, you're more or less concerned in your own personal life. You're not sitting down being philosophical and thinking about things a great deal like that. You're thinking about girlfriends and dances and so forth. But you just knew the crowd, the town was growing. For instance, I remember the time that I was bragging that there were almost 50,000 blacks here. I remember saying that and thinking that was an astronomical figure.
When was that, you were saying that?
Oh, I would say that I said that about 1927, 28. Yeah. And you saw no blacks living on the other side of San Pedro Street, except a few, you know, that would... were willing to risk a whole lot of trouble, or they got in a nest of white neighbors that were not opposed. You could run into that. You have a good fortune to run into that. But that's the way the situation was.
Mm-hmm.
50,000 blacks at that time looked like a great big figure.
What were the most important organizations that you remember?
Well, there's... no question that the NAACP was very important, kept people mobilized. Then the lodges, the Eastern Star, the Elks, the Masons, they were active. There were groups persons who I think they might have been, you might classify as white liberals they might have been communists, but they would also give stags and smoke outs around the town, and they weren't, all of us weren't invited, you know what I mean? But I know they'd be going on. And
What's a smoke out?
Stags.
What's that?
Stags, nothing but men.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, they would, instead of, when I say smoke out, the real name was smoker. So at the smoker, you go in a room crowded with smoke, and you could hardly see each other, and that was the fad. And they would sit around for hours and talk over the problems in these smoke-filled rooms. And of course, it was a great health hazard, and they sooner or later they stopped it. But they stopped using the word stag and would use the word smoker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whenever I think of Lauren Miller, I think of smoker, because Lauren would always be posed with a cigarette like enough. Lauren was the number two man to Ralph Bunch as far as accomplishment was concerned. And you see, I always remember seeing Lauren with a cigarette. Lauren was a, have you heard of Thurgood Marshall? Lauren was an associate of Thurgood Marshall. They're about the same age. And they both tackled the same problems. And that's just about it.
When you mentioned those organizations before, like the Elks and the Masons, and did you have any involvement or with these groups?
I was what you call a fraternity man. The Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, there are three black national fraternities among college men, and that's the Alpha Phi Alpha, the Omega Psi Phi, and the Kappa Alpha Psi. They all aspire to own fraternity houses in the various cities. You find them very strong on college campuses. Alpha Phi Alpha was originated at Cornell University, and it has chapters. For instance, when I went to Boston in 1926 around, and I wanted to go out and socialize and meet some of the youngsters in school, and I was taking out a girl out in Boston, and here comes a big affair coming up on Saturday night. She's asking me if I'm going, and I said, no, I don't know anything about it. She said, well, are you a frat man? I said, no. And she says, well, I'm sorry, I got an invitation. And she says, it's a closed party. So you couldn't do anything socially unless you were a frat member. And now this is, I brought this to show you, this is where I was already in the Alpha. And when I came back to Los Angeles out of school, this is where they were forming a graduate chapter here. And this is, I happen to be one of the charter members, you see, and I noticed it's the year 1940. See, most of these people are dead.
Mm-hmm.
And
so this was the chapter here in L.A.
Right. So this is a flourishing chapter here now. So here is where the...
But you got involved when you went to college in Ohio?
Or, yes. Yeah. I was a... Alpha before I went back there to Ohio.
When you went to you were in Boston first?
No, when I went to Ohio.
Okay.
I was an Alpha then. As a matter of fact, you know, you've heard Jesse Owens.
Uh-huh.
Well, I helped initiate Jesse Owens in our frat at Ohio State.
Really?
So, yeah, and he and I have been friends.
What kind of initiations did you have?
It was rough. It was battles, and it was rough. Now here is, this is from behalf of the chapter. We would like to send you our warm respect. In addition, the purpose is to advise you that our chapter would like to honor you as one of the founders of this chapter. Confirm your reservation. Now, I went to this affair that night just knowing it was an Alpha affair, but never dreaming that I'm a charter member. You see, that is one of the founders. So when they sent me this letter and sent me this, I thought they'd made a mistake. And I found my signature, see?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so this was only 3 years after I got out of school, after I started practicing. So this is I remember going to this affair. And all these guys are dead and gone, most of them.
Wow.
I think there are two left.
Wow. Were there any other kinds of social clubs? They weren't necessarily with a college and the university.
Let's see.
Were you a member of any of those?
The clubs. Fraternities, the fraternity parties kept us busy. For instance, there were two real fine women sororities. There was Alpha Kappa Alpha and Delta, I've forgotten that would have been a crime 10 years ago. But
it'll come back, right?
We just called them the Deltas. And these were well-selected, well-groomed, smart, intelligent college women, and they would give their affairs, and then they would extend invitations to the various men of these other fraternities, the three men's fraternities, and then the Alpha Kappa Alpha was another one. Now, since that time, as years go by, a lot of groups, people organized, and they found out it's not against the law to use a Greek letter name if you haven't been to the university. So they've started a lot of, the Rokuku and all that. There are folk who start up fraternities and sororities, but who have never been to school or anything like that.
So it's really is like a social club outside of a university.
It's a social club today. But in those days, it was more or less confined in university.
Very exclusive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Black Ball was in... Are you a sorority woman?
No.
All right. Well,
my mom is.
Black Ball was very prevalent. And one person voting against you getting in this organization, you out. I mean, you couldn't get in. You're not out, but you couldn't get in. So you...